Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, allies, and students scattered across time and space, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on Friday, January 18th, 2013. And this is Navigator Briefing number 37. The title is The Matangi Eye. Before I start the briefing, let me correct a small error in detail from the talk that was posted recently entitled Kalki Avatar. This talk is not listed under the nav briefings, but you'll find it under the GNE crew notes or GNE audio files, on gaiaspora.org. At the end of that talk, I referred to the Matangi shift of 2012. Actually, I meant 2013. Now, while I'm on the subject of the Dakini shifts, this would be a good place to lead into the subject of this briefing. The Dakini shifts, for those of you who follow the Gaian Navigation Experiment, are, as you know, simply a way that we track the moods of the planetary animal mother month by month. The Dakini shifts are a way for us to, they present a way for us to read her mind, as it were. I can tell you with confidence, and I can assure you that I speak in a literal way when I say that the planetary goddess Sophia transmits subliminally into the human mind on different frequency bands month by month. And it is actually possible to observe what these bands are and to tune in to the particular bands of broadcast that she utilizes one month after another. The identification of the bands is the practice of observing the lunar shaktis. And the identification of the bands requires interactive presence with the cosmos. By observing the crescent moon in the west after sunset, those in this practice can detect which Dakini comes on shift. Dakini on shift is a metaphor for the transmitting frequency of that 28-29 day period. So that, in a nutshell, is the method of transception of subliminal frequencies in the mind of the planetary wisdom goddess and in the mind of the human species, as it is attuned to her, as all other animals are attuned to her as well. Just as field mice or monarch butterflies, whales, walruses, animals of the Serengeti, caribou, Arctic bears, just as all of these animals are obviously and undeniably attuned to the mother planet, so are human animals. Because of the complexity of our makeup, our cerebral and neurochemical circuits allow us to tune in to very fine and discrete frequencies in the transmissions coming directly from the body-mind of the Aeon Sophia, which is the planet Earth. And this is the method of observing the lunar shaktis. I know that some of you on the crew love this method and feel comfortable with it and really enjoy tuning in to the new frequency each month. You love that first moment when you hear it in your mind, when there's a certain tonality or a certain theme or image that flashes out of your subconscious and you go into a kind of eureka moment, you recognize that you are detecting the presence of a certain frequency transmitted from the earth itself. So it is that we observe these lunar cycles. And I must say that in the many, many years that I have followed this practice, which goes back further than I would care to mention, I have never felt more excitement about it than I do right now. Let me be precise about the current operation of the lunar Shaktis, as we call them colloquially, drawing from the old Dravidian or southern Indian tradition of matriarchal goddess mysticism. The conditions of the lunar Shaktis from the end of 2012 into 2013 are extraordinary and unique, and they mark a critical and decisive moment in the life of the human species. On December 13th, 2012, there was a new moon marking the end of that lunar cycle, that 29-day lunar period. The overseeing devata of that lunar period, which had begun on the 14th of November, was Kamala. The instruction of Kamala concerns the mystery of love and death and the interconnection between the human capacity to experience love and the necessity of a mortal animal to undergo death. Each of the 10 Mahavidyas and the 6 Diamond Skaidakinis have particular teachings, including Vivi herself, although Vivi does not operate on any particular shift. And it is possible over the course of time to learn the specific instructions that characterize each Dakini, each Mahavidya. They are specialists in what they teach. And so, as I explained at the beginning of the Kamala cycle in the middle of November, I, for the first time, was able to grasp the instructions of that particular Dakini, and I recorded my reflections in the talk, Kamala's Wedding. Now, coming into December and the critical month, the long-awaited month of December 2012, we found that Kurukula came on shift on the 14th of December. That was the day of the alleged massacre of children at the Sandy Hill Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, the 14th of December, the very first day of the Kurukula shift. So it came to pass, to use an old biblical syntax, that in those days, when the long-awaited moment of the winter solstice of 2012 arrived, that it arrived within the shift of the Diamond Sky Dakini Kurukula, who is a teacher of witchcraft and sexual and lethal magic, a teacher of high, high Gaian witchcraft. Interesting correlation there. I submit for your consideration that the high witchcraft or sorcery of Kurukula, which is Gaian sorcery, might just be coming into focus and definition and efficacy at this moment when this horrific event was perpetrated, whatever that event may have been. Just taking it on face value, this massacre of children. And I submit to you that if there is some kind of satanic magic working on this planet, it would reveal itself in that event in a particular way, but at the same time that it reveals itself in that event, Kurukula stands with her magic, with her sorcery, against those satanic powers and against the deceit, terror, and manipulation proceeding from those satanic powers. And I would submit that this moment, marked in everyone's mind across this planet, marked in the way the Kennedy assassination was marked in people's minds, in the way that 9/11 was marked in people's minds, that this moment of the Sandy Hook massacre is marked and anchored and tagged in the human subconscious and in the collective unconscious of the human race. And the way that it is tagged and embedded in the psyche of the human race may prove to be extremely decisive for the future of our species. Coming forward from that day, we see the change of the year clocking up to 2013, and the Kurukula shift continues until the 11th of January. At that day, on that day, there's a new moon in 22 degrees of Capricorn, marking the end of the Kurukula shift. Anticipating that moment, I asked the question, as some of you did as well, well, who comes on shift after Kurukula? Whose shift begins on the 12th of January, 2013, and continues until, I believe, February 11th? The way it goes in this method of following the lunar cycles, the shift is announced by the appearance of the crescent moon, the first early faint crescent after sunset, in a particular locale. Each of the Mahavidyas of the Shakti cluster and each of the diamond sky Dakinis is correlated to a constellation. Kamala is the scorpion, Kurukula the archer, Mahakali, the goatfish, Matangi, the Manitou, or water bearer, formerly called Aquarius in astrology, Swan Deva, the fishes, and so forth. There you see a linear and chronological progression of the constellations in their natural order. Scorpion, archer, goatfish, Manitou, and so forth. But the Dakini shifts are not strictly linear or predictable. They depend on turbulent and precarious conditions, as well as atmospheric conditions, conditions of observation. Initially, I had thought that I would call the January shift beginning on the 12th, for Mahakali. But I didn't get to see the crescent moon at that time. I didn't get to see the faint crescent on the Sunday evening of the 13th or even the 14th. I didn't observe it. Now, the observation of the crescent is a crucial factor in determining who comes on shift, but it's not the only factor. The practice of inner listening or clairaudience also plays an extremely crucial role in determining who comes on shift. Well, I was uncertain about the Kurukula, the successor of Kurukula. The reason being that I cheated a little bit and went to look at stellarium.org, and I could see that the crescent moon following the new moon of the 11th of January had a very short window of opportunity to appear in the goldfish But then quite rapidly, it would pass into the succeeding constellation to the left, that is to the east, and that would be the constellation of the Manitou, so the shift would fall to Matangi. I initially called it for Mahakali, but I came to be convinced in a most powerful way. On the third day of the shift, I came to be convinced that it was Matangi leading the instruction for this ensuing month. At a precise moment, which would have been sometime in the afternoon on Monday the 14th, the certainty of this shift came to me in a spectacular manner. Two things happened simultaneously. First was that I received a gift from Matangi, and I knew from the nature of the gift who the giver was. Matangi didn't appear to me. She didn't announce her name. She didn't call out to me and say, hi, here I am. I'm Matangi, and I'm giving you this. I knew from the nature of the gift itself that it came from her. And at the same time, I had an image or an understanding in my mind about the special relationship, the unique and powerful coordination of the infernal powers of the goddess that is now in effect, that is now underway. I had had a strong intuition during the preceding Kurukula shift that Kali herself was somehow operating within that shift. And so I came up with the notion that Kurukula and Kali were doubling on the shift, that it was mainly Kurukula's shift, it was mainly her instruction, but Kali was seconding her and standing side by side her during her shift. I got the same impression again on the third day of this shift, that Matangi was the presiding devata, the tutelary deity, or Ishta Devata, as they're called in Hindu goddess mysticism. But at the same time, the presence of Kali was palpable. And I offer to you this image of three women. Picture before yourself three warrior women. In the center is Kali herself, and she has her arms bent so that her hands formed into fists are at her side. Her hands are closed into fists, and the fists rest on her two ribs, the right side, the ribs of the right side, and the ribs of the left side of her body. And she stands with legs spread in a powerful posture of a warrior who cannot be moved, of an invincible and immovable force. And on the right of her and on the left of her stand two other women as well in the same posture, and their arms are linked through Kali's arms. In such a manner is Kurukula linked to Kali on one side, and Matangi linked to Kali on the other side. And these three aspects of the infernal magic of this living planet of ours, these three aspects now form a front line of Gaian eco-sorcery, a front line of defense and offense. And this front line, formed now, formed right at this moment, when the calendar turns from 2012 to 2013, is the front line in the war for the Anthropos and for the Earth itself. The war against the orchestrations of satanic magic on this planet. And these three female goddesses, or all aspects of the divine Sophia, define not only the moment, but the strategy of Kalikas who undertake this war. Oh, such is the vision that I offer at this moment, the vision I have in my mind's eye, a vision I hold in my heart, which you may find appropriate to share, this powerful image of three warrior women locked together, arm to arm. You know, the gesture of fists on ribs is a shamanic gesture of power. And so there they are, Kurukula on one side of Kali, Matangi on the other, locked into her arms. But of course, their outer arms are free. So you might imagine them as holding their outer arms up to their ribs. But you can also imagine Matangi and Kurukula as they flank Kali with their legs spread and braced in a posture of power. You might also imagine them as slapping their thighs with the free hand. And the sound of that, here, let me do it again. The sound of that, slapping the thigh, is the war call to Kalikas. So having said that, I would like to make a quick qualification regarding the firewall of the Gaia navigation experiment. In some respect, I'm taking the firewall down. Remember that the firewall is what divides my talks concerning the particulars of the GNE as I initially proposed, the terms of observation, the terms of navigation. The difference between those talks and talks about Kalatantra per se, the triangle of love, war, and magic, and so forth. It's my perception, friends and crew members, that it is actually impossible to proceed in full commitment to the GNE at this time without entering into a Kalika stance and undertaking what I call the magic of Gaian psychotronics, that is to say, Gaian echo sorcery, the arts of war, in Kali's terms, the arts of psychological war. It's impossible to continue in the GNE and really have a serious commitment other than to just be like another passenger who happens to wander up on the navigation deck and hear me talking. I mean, if that's what you are, fine. But if that is not the case, this would be the moment to renew your commitment to the GNE and understand that you're now faced with double duty. You're not only following the nav and learning how to track the mothership and follow and participate with the wisdom goddess as she sets the initial conditions of correction, but you're also stepping forward behind that united front of three infernal Dakini women. You're stepping into those ranks now, and there's no other way to go about it. There's no other way to proceed from this point on. I'm not going to give an elaborate explanation of why I say that at this moment, But I can assure you it will become eminently clear in the next few talks that I release. However, let me assure you as well that I am not entirely taking down the firewall. I intend to speak of every aspect of Kalika warfare tactics, Kalika warfare instruction, tools, weapons, both of defense and offense, and every single technical aspect of Gaian psychotronics that I can squeeze out of my cells as the transmission comes to me and through me. And I intend to impart all of those things, but I will not impart anything about the lethal strike. So in undertaking the stance of a Kalika warrior at this time, you are not obligated to become accessory to the lethal strike, and to that extent, the firewall still stands. Now, before I return to the fascinating matter of the gift that I received from Matangi, let me be meticulously clear in the time-factored conditions of my present talk. I began this talk on January 18th, Friday, which, by the way, was the anniversary of the day that I met my beloved friend, Jan Michelle Kerouac, in New York City. I had a bit of a break, a lapse, and I am picking it up now in the early hours of the 22nd of January. Well, what does that say? I am talking to you out of an apogee surge, the lunar apogee having reached 10 degrees of Gemini, where it has been stalled for about 2 months. And I am also speaking to you as we go into a Channel 16 moment. At 4 a.m. here, Spanish time, that is to say about 3 hours from now, the occultation of Jupiter occurs. So I'm speaking to you in the very early hours of that day, January 22nd. And what I want to make clear before I get back to the main topic of this briefing is the extraordinary situation that pertains, beginning with the Kurukula shift of December 2012, carrying through to the Matangi shift of January 2013, with possibly another Matangi shift in February of 2013. I want to emphasize that some of you may be experiencing, I want to indicate rather, that some of you may be experiencing the intense Kali energies that are now escalating across this planet. Especially for those of us who observe interactive magic with Gaia, as I have defined planetary tantra. Especially for those of us on the crew who participate in the emotions and intentions of the planetary mother, animal mother. Especially for us, the intensification and escalation of the Kali forces is going through the roof and going to continue to do so. And as this occurs, the Kali presence herself will be seconding in the shifts of the other Dakinis. So as I said, you might have read the December shift as you might have read Kali's presence very strongly. She was there with Kurukula. Now, January 2013, she is there with Matangi. And I think again and again of this expression that warriors use, that cops use, spies and people in the special military, black ops, I've got your back. Kali now has got the back of the other Dakinis who come on shift, and they are coordinating in a most dynamic and intimate fashion to set up the conditions, the initial conditions, for a massive act of psychological warfare coming from the Anthropos rather than directed upon it. Coming from and through the Anthropos, a kind of Gaian psyops, if you will, a massive psyops is now under preparation. And I myself am doing double duty as of that fateful day, December 14th, 2012, the Sandy Hook Day. I myself am doing double duty. I speak to you always and ever as your navigator and also as the Calico warrior, learning and sharing the strategies of this momentous event, of this momentous challenge. All during the spring of 2013, the initial conditions of this Gaian psyop, this feat of counter magic, are being established. Or to say it without using the passive voice, the trinity of those divine powers, enforced and guided by Vivi herself, are setting the initial conditions for what is to be the first attempt ever to launch a massive counterattack on the satanic magic operating on this planet. So as you attune to my words in the coming months of this spring, and as you attune to the moon, and in your own fashion, transceive and translate the Dakini frequencies, and as you attune to each other through channel 16, and become more at ease and perhaps even adept with using that powerful console, that powerful intercom of the Shakti cluster, as you do, bear in mind that Kali is doubling with Kurukula, with Matangi, and that there may be a second Matangi shift in February. But even if there isn't, Matangi continues to double as we would move into the shift of Swan Deva. And that may be, if I could call it, and I don't think it can be called, but that may be the point with Matangi doubling and holding the back of Swan Deva in the February shift. The point that I know so many of you have been wondering about, the big, big question we live with among the many big questions of the GNE, and that is the question of defeating the great lie by destroying the narrative. The great advantage of the perpetrators on this planet is that they have control of the narrative that is fed into the collective psyche, both at the conscious level, which is through cultural media and technology, and at the subconscious level. What would happen if the narrative could be changed? If the narrative could be changed, the course of history could be changed. And I have a very good sense that by February and March of this year, we will at least be able to see how that could be done, although I cannot guarantee that we will see it done. So bear that distinction in mind, and may it keep you humble and keep you safe, as warriors need to be humble and safe. So, to return to the subject of this briefing, the Matangi Eye. What is the Matangi Eye? Well, rather than just give you a definition of it, may I take the time to take you through my experience, through my realization and reflections that brought me to an understanding of what the Matangi Eye is. It really began to get interesting, to use that word. It really began to get intense, and the instruction turned more or less excruciating for me almost exactly 2 years ago. You may recall, as the whole world might recall, that there was an earthquake in Haiti in January of 2010. And at that moment, I got the message, as you might put it. A kind of glimpse or flicker of instruction came through into my mind. A kind of subliminal flash occurred. And I knew at that moment that Kurukula was being handed the direction of the Shakti cluster. Now, how did I understand that instruction? I understood that Vivi herself, who is the totality of the whole Shakti cluster, she is not only the 18th node in the 18-point matrix, but she is the totality of the matrix. In the same way, they say in the Sri Vidya mysticism of southern India, which is the historical precedent for the Shakti cluster, or the 10 Mahavidyas anyway, they say that the 10 Mahavidyas are all emanations of Kali. So there is Kali herself, the first Mahavidya, and then all the other nine are just emanations of the Kali, emanations of the Kali, primal Kali force. Well, likewise, the whole Shakti cluster of 18 points, just emanations of VV. And as such, she is the directing power of that turbulent field of subliminal bioelectrical magnetic power, which is alive and conscious. But what I detected in January of 2010, sort of quivering from the effects and aftershocks of the Haiti earthquake, was that in preparation for a great act of witchcraft that she herself would perform, the planetary animal mother is a great witch. You might imagine her as a scarlet woman riding on a beast. That she herself was preparing the counter magic to the evil and deceit on this planet. And that in order to do that, she had to be, as it were, hands free of the routine management of the Shakti cluster, as it were. So she handed over the direction and management of it to Kurukula. And I saw this clear as day at the time. And I thought, what the fuck does this mean? And what are the implications and repercussions of what I'm seeing? And I struggled a lot with it at that time and in subsequent months, because I wasn't, until now, able to make too much out of it. Now I understand that there is an alignment happening, that Kurukula in one way and Matangi in another way are aligned with Kali as a kind of arrow, with Kali at the head of the arrow. And the construction of this magical arrow of force has one purpose, and that is to destroy the illusions that make it possible for evil to be perpetrated on this planet and for evil people to prevail over those who are good. To destroy those illusions, because Kali destroys illusions. And now I see that Matangi and Kurukula are intimately paired, as you see if you look at the oval formation of the Shakti cluster. They are intimately paired at the base of the vertical axis of the cluster, with Kali herself at the apex. Now we come around to a couple of years later. And in that same month of January, imagine this happening. Here is Turton standing there in a room, and it's as if in front of him, at eye level, or a little higher than eye level, looking up slightly, and within the grasp of his arm, within arm's reach, there appeared an object, a knife. And so the Turton reached out and took this knife. Now, consider closely how he took it. He took it by the blade. It was floating in space with the handle up, the blade, and the point of the blade pointing down. And he took it by the blade. Well, it's a very sharp knife, needless to say, and it's a good thing that the blade was in a sheath, because otherwise I might have hurt myself. So I took this knife by the sheath, and so I accepted the gift that Mutangi gave me. This is a special, special knife, and with this knife, Kaleka warriors can open the operation of offensive strategy against the deceit and evil on this planet as it operates psychically and psychologically and subliminally. This is a psyop. This is psychological warfare that we're talking about here. Strategies of psychological warfare, because the war that is being waged on the earth, as all of you know, I'm sure, is primarily a war in the mind and a war of the mind. Fear is a tool of psychological war. What is the opposite tool? Delight. So you see, it's time to come and learn these strategies. The time has come to learn these strategies, I should say. Fear, if fear is a tool of psychological warfare, so can delight be a tool of psychological warfare as a counter force to fear. Now, when I reached up and snatched this gift of this dagger out of the air, metaphorically speaking, I was exquisitely aware at that moment that I held the sheath in my hand. The sheath, like the leather sheath. It not only protected my hand from the blade, a warrior does not want to be harmed by his or her own weapon, but it also allowed me to grasp it by the blade until the moment when I am ready to grasp it by the handle. You see the difference? I grasped it by the blade, protected by the sheath. Holding it in that way, the next move is to grasp the knife, Mutangi's blade, at the handle and withdraw it from the sheath and strike with that blade. But first, of course, it's necessary to know what is this blade and how to use it. Now, I was also explicitly clear at the moment of this marvelous experience, receiving a gift from a Dakini, that I would receive first the operative syntax for the sheath that holds this blade of Mutangi is just as important as the blade itself. And I understood at that moment, and I did receive at that moment, the operative syntax of the sheath. And I understood that sometime later, and it won't be long, folks, hang on to your panties, the world would receive the operative syntax for the blade. So my intention here in this talk is to tell you what it is, the syntax of the sheath. And in that context to transmit the instruction of the Matangi Eye. When I grasped the sheath of Matangi's knife, a question formed in my mind. It's a question that anyone might have asked. It's a question about a real event in this world, an event that happened in this world, in the memory of some of us who are over 50 or over 60, and in the memory of a lot of younger people who never lived through that event, which occurred in 1963, on November 22nd. So, interestingly, the formula of syntax that corresponds to the sheath is a question about that event. And this question, as soon as it was formed in my mind, and it sort of formed itself, I didn't ponder about it or anything, it just spontaneously formed itself into a question, I was stunned by this question. Now, I don't know if you will be or not. Maybe you will find it to be of no great significance, or it may be completely unremarkable to you. I don't know. You'll see in a moment. But I was stunned by the fact that I had never heard anyone ask this question before. Now, regarding this event of November 22nd, 1963, I have heard a lot of people ask a lot of questions about that event. Haven't you? And I have read books and discussed those books and watched documentaries concerning that event in which countless questions have been raised and investigated and many of them solved. As a matter of fact, some years back, I think it was around 2007, when I came across evidence of revision, and the man who killed Kennedy, I realized that the crime had been solved. Why? Because some incredibly devoted individuals who were not paid for anything they did dedicated and consecrated decades of their lives to solve this crime. And it has been solved to my satisfaction in a manner that would stand up in any criminal court, if criminal courts were really what they were supposed to be. So thousands of questions asked about the incidents of that day. But I was stunned when I got the question with the gift, because as far as I know, no one has ever asked this question, and it is the omission of asking this question that Matangi used to signal my mind to her instruction. It's the omission of this question that she uses now to get your attention, just as she got mine. The omission of this question in the immense amount of investigation of that event is really quite remarkable. And so the question is simply this. You can put up your hand if you want to and hold it out in front of you. And curl around the fingers like you're curling them around the leather sheath that holds a very powerful magical weapon. And squeeze it slightly and take it into your hand and ask yourself, where is the network and affiliate footage of the motorcade on the day of the JFK assassination? Now, you see, that question is purely historical and purely existential. It's not metaphysical. It's not, doesn't have anything magical about it. It's a very simple, common sense question. Now, I'm not going to go into a long commentary about this question, but let me repeat it. Where is the network and affiliate footage of the motorcade on the day of the JFK assassination? Question mark. Have you ever heard anyone talk about that footage? Have you ever heard anyone mention it? Have you ever heard anyone among the hundreds of people who have dedicated their lives to investigating that horrible crime / psyop / act of satanic magic / coup d'etat? Have you ever heard anyone say why it's missing, or even make the observation that it's missing? I haven't. Now, I'm not going to elaborate on it. I'm just going to leave it to your mind to take the gift of Matanki into your own hands and proceed from there by contemplating this question. But in order to steer you a little bit in that direction, if I may, let me offer two observations. The first observation is that there was certainly network and affiliate footage being taken on that day by camera crews, by affiliate, you know, I mean the NBC, ABC, or CBS local affiliate, the local Dallas TV station, not to mention NBC, CBS, their film crews who follow the president to every event then, just as they do now. So, you may recall, who does not recall, the pictures of JFK and his wife, Jackie, descending from the presidential airplane at Love Field and being received at Love Field in Dallas by an enchanted and affectionate crowd of people. Now, that was not non-professional footage. That was professional camera team footage, either of a network or of an affiliate in Dallas, an affiliate to ABC. Either the ABC mainstream network camera crew was there or their affiliates were there. Later on that morning, the president gave a talk, and that talk was likewise covered by film crews. How come? That's professional camera work, professional film crews, whose job is to follow the president to such events, whose job is to film such motorcades, no matter how boring or routine they may be. Now, second observation I want to make is that the film that the world has seen reported to show the actual assassination of JFK in the motorcade was not made by a professional, was it? And so the world has been provided with evidence, filmed evidence, but it is not films from professional crews employed by news networks. Well, why not? Weren't there professional crews following the motorcade? Okay. We're left with a mystery here. We're left with a big question. And I assure you, though it may not appear obvious at first that this has anything to do with how we can wage psychological warfare against the adversaries of the Anthropos and the Earth, I assure you it goes right to the heart of that strategy. Second thing to observe is that, first of all, the Zapruder film has been doctored. And you can see how exactly how it was doctored by going to YouTube and typing in the Zapruder film hoax, parts 1 through 6, where a very sober gentleman named Jack White, I believe, takes you step by step through the construction of how it was done. Now, I'm not going to go into the details, but I will point out one crucial factor, which again is essential to Matangi's question, her first question. The Zapruder film, as everyone knows, begins by showing the limousine at a distance. Zapruder himself was on a pedestal on the grassy knoll, and therefore he was filming to his left, up the street, to the corner where the limousine came into Dealey Plaza and then made a left turn descending down into Dealey Plaza. So the first shot we all see upon watching the Zapruder film is the approach of the limousine along the side of the street where the Texas Depository building is, just as it gets to the place where it makes the left turn descending into Dealey Plaza. And then there's a break. And it's as if Zapruder turned off the camera for a few frames. And then when the action picks up again, the limousine has already descended to a certain degree into Dealey Plaza. So what is it that you don't see? Again, the omission is the key to gaining the Matangi eye. When you see what has been omitted, you are gaining the Matangi eye. What's missing in the Zapruder film is the frames that show the limousine on the turn. And what you will see if you watch this presentation called the Zapruder Film Hoax, I think it's called that. It's called The Great Zapruder Film Hoax, and it's in 6 parts. If you watch that, you will see that the gentleman who put this together soberly and meticulously explains that the assassination really happened on the curve. The curve was the killing zone. But you never saw that, did you? I never saw that. No one in the world saw that. Quite simply, because the frames showing the car on the curve were cut out of the film. Which raises the question, where is the network and affiliate footage of the motorcade that would have been taken from any number of other positions in the plaza and would have shown the car go into the kill zone, veer widely around the curve, widely and wildly, and that is when the first shots were taken. And so when the Zapruder film picks up again and you see Kennedy, he's already been hit. But the film has been doctored so that you don't see that. And the famous headshot has also been doctored. So I leave you to investigate that matter of the deconstruction of the Zapruder film to your satisfaction. And as I conclude this talk, I'd like to tell you why I would even require you to go back and think of such a moment in time. I do it because, as far as I can tell, Matangi requires this. She requires this review, she requires this looking back, and then coming forward from that moment as an exercise to be undergone by those who want to regain the Matangi eye. Without the Matangi eye, it is impossible to fight the psychological war that is now breaking open, that is now breaking into action. It is impossible to fight it without the Matangi eye. with it is impossible to use the knife, whose significance is yet to be revealed. The knife that is contained in that sheath that you hold in your hand, it is impossible to use it skillfully or correctly without the Matangi eye. And so what Matangi requires, as I understand, is to go back in time with your eyes, because we're talking about photographic evidence, and the operative word here is photographic, to go back to November 22nd, 1963, and look at what has been omitted. Then to come ahead to September 11th, 2001, the next major PSYOP against humanity, and look at what has been omitted, what was not seen. And then come ahead to the Sandy Hook massacre, December 14th, 2012, and look at what was not seen. Look at what was omitted in the photographic evidence. And by putting these three events side by side and in sequence and reviewing them, the exercise that you go through will prepare you and position you to regain the Matangi eye. And once you regain that eye, in the first 3 or 4 months of 2013, the Dakinis themselves, Vivi herself, and the frontline Dakinis, Kali, Kurukula, and Matangi, make available to you and to me and to anyone who cares to listen and watch and learn the strategies for using her knife and for using her power. What is the power of Matangi? It's my pleasure to tell you that it is the power to defeat the trickster. I wrote in that fateful year of 2010, not long after the Haiti earthquake, when I had the intuition I previously described, I wrote a piece for metahistory.org, which is not even listed anywhere on the site. It's on the site, but there's no link to it. It shows you how things go with me. I posted it on the 15th of March, 2010, the last day of the Matangi shift of that year, and it is called Matangi the Outcast, She Who Vanquishes Deceit. And at the time that I wrote that, I was given the intuition that Matangi is supreme and outstanding in the entire Shakti cluster, in that she is the Dakini who teaches how to defeat the trickster. And how do you defeat a trickster? Well, I'm sure you already know before the words come out of my mouth. To defeat a trickster, you have to use a trick. You see, the problem with truth, my friends, and I love truth. You know, the reason why I do everything is because I love truth and I hate lies. And I find lies, deceit, and secrecy to be ugly and boring. I love truth. And that is why I teach Planetary Tantra. And that is why I do everything that I've done. I do it from the love of truth. But let me tell you, truth is not enough. Exposing the truth about the predators and perpetrators and psychopaths is not enough. Truth is necessary. Truth is wonderful. The more truth that gets out there, the better. The truth about the banking system, the truth about how the game is rigged in banking, in international banking, the truth about the constant deceit of politicians, how they do nothing but lie. Get it out there, but don't expect it to be decisive in the ultimate confrontation that is coming, which would be the fourth, final, and paramount blow to the Anthropos. And it is coming. I don't make a prediction, but my gut level feeling is that it's coming. And my gut level feeling is that the Sandy Hook PSYOP was a test. It's not on the level of the JFK assassination or 9/11. But it's very much in sequence with those events. It falls perfectly in sequence with those events because it was a test of the psyche, of the collective psyche, and of the resistance movement to position the monsters to make their final move. It's a test. It's a PSYOP that is a test of how well their strategies of deceit and division are working. And when that moment comes of that third and final assault, truth is not going to save the day, because the only way to defeat a trickster is by a trick. Ask Matangi, show me the trick to defeat the trickster. Ask her. She is the one who teaches this. And, of course, it goes without saying that you cannot defeat the trickster if you don't even know what a trickster is. Or who is the trickster? Who am I talking about here? Am I talking about Satan? You know? Am I talking about Lucifer? You know? Mephistopheles? Oh, that's a good one. Haven't brought that up yet, have I? Remember a while back I quoted a passage from Goethe's Faust. I'm going to get back to that soon. That is a very, very pertinent piece of intel. But for right now, I conclude with a reference back to my essay on Matangi, in which I wrote, or which I quoted actually, a paragraph from a book by Wade Davis called The Serpent and the Rainbow, a book about voodoo in Haiti, in which he says, quote, "The longer I remained in Haiti, and the more I learned of the Voodoo society, the more impressed I was by its internal cohesion. Sorcery was certainly a potent force to be dealt with, but to a great extent it had been institutionalized as a critical component of the worldview. To ask why there is sorcery in Haiti is to ask why there is evil in the world. And the answer, if there is one, is the same answer that is provided by all great religions. Evil is the mirror of good, the necessary complement that completes the whole of creation. The Haitians, as much as any people, are conscious of this sacred balance." End quote. Well, you'll see if you read this piece, which you can find by putting in Manitou Matangi into the search engine, Manitou Matangi, it will come up. You'll see that I object to a couple of things in this quote, but I totally concur that evil is the mirror of good. And I elaborate on my understanding of that in this essay. So what I would say to you now is that there are two steps in requiring the Matangi eye, which has been blinded in the human animal, blinded intentionally by the archons. Two steps. The first step is to invite back the eye. The way that you invite it back is by committing yourself to see evil as the mirror of good. The opportunity to face the evil on this planet mirrors to you your own goodness in a way that nothing else can. It's not goodness that mirrors goodness. It's in the mirror of evil that you see your own goodness. And the willingness to see that, the longing, the desire to see that, is what I call inviting the Matangi eye. The second step is to reclaim the Matangi eye. And you do that by contemplating this question: where is the network and affiliate footage of the motorcade on the day of the JFK assassination? And while you're asking that question, ask the question that follows from that, at least in my mind: how can it be that almost going on for 50 years now, no one, even those who've dedicated their lives to investigate that event, has asked that question? Omission. Seeing the omission is the key to reclaiming the Matangi eye. That's where I would leave it at the moment. I might add, just as a kind of a parting thrill to give you a little bit of a shiver of delight, that it is extremely important to observe that among the Dakinis and Devadas and infernal bitches and witches of the Shakti cluster, there is only one who has an active male counterpart. And guess who that is? And I have indicated this before, but it may be total news to some of you, that the active male counterpart of Matangi is called in Tibetan Buddhism the buffalo-headed Yamantaka. The buffalo-headed Yamantaka. Go and look it up. And take away with you from this talk the assurance that not only does Matangi have the psychological, psychotronic magic to defeat the trickster, but she also has the brawn and power to back up that defeat. There's no point in making any threats to anybody unless you can back them up. Matangi has the power to back up her magic. She has the masculine power represented in this awesome image of the buffalo-headed Yamantaka. So you might want to take a look at that sometime and contemplate that beast. Until the next time I come around and talk to you again. Love and courage to all, and safe passage until that moment.